It hide behind discs. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled. Fear to bring children into the world. For threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know but to talk out of turn? You might say that I'm young. You might say I'm unlearned. But there's the one thing I know. I'm younger than you. Even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. And I hope that you die, and your death will come soon. I follow your casket by the pale afternoon. And I watch while you're lured down to your deathbed. And I stand over your grave till I'm sure that you're dead.
Okay, well, I didn't think I was going to have time for that, but since I had another computer problem, I needed the time to get set up, and I guess I'm kind of set up playing that because Dylan is playing that out after about 17-year hiatus. Played it at a couple of concerts. It's a chilling song. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. Of course, my name's Paul Muth. This is News from Neptune in the Radio Edit. And when I called in on the Higher Ground show, I mentioned I was going to play Sundiata's piece, part of it actually. Might come up again. Cope Cumpston was interested in it. She's been replaying this Summer of Solidarity material And again, that's coming up on Wednesdays as part of the Weft Courier. So if you miss that or you want to reprise some of the ideas, this will be the fifth panel that was at the IMC. Oh, no, actually, it was at Channing Murray. Okay. No Mumi Abu-Jamal commentary. Let's get on with the Breaking the Sound Barrier essay about the Smithsonian crackdown on history. And Web Exclusive is a piece that she did some years ago when Lonnie Bunch took over the Smithsonian. He's particularly getting the ire of the mad one, our own Nero in the White House. I already gave a disclaimer, didn't I? So much, so quick. Greg Pallast on FEMA and emergency response, but of course he does reprise his election issue. Yesterday, David Daley was on. He has the book out, Anti-Democratic, Inside the Far Right's 50-Year Plot to Control American Elections. It's quite well spoken. So both on the same election suppression territory. Pallas goes as far as saying that if there wasn't for election suppression, Trump wouldn't have won. So he runs the numbers, being the numbers guy. Okay, let's hear Amy's piece about, attempt to obliterate history.
On the Smithsonian and slavery, Trump's whitewashing of history. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. On Tuesday, President Trump attacked the narrative long taught in U.S. schools and documented in museums about the abhorrent centuries-long practice of slavery. He focused on the Smithsonian Institution, the world-renowned center of learning and culture based in Washington, D.C., Trump wrote on his social media platform, quote, "The Smithsonian is out of control, where everything discussed is how horrible our country is, how bad slavery was," he wrote. How bad slavery was? It's simply unbelievable that such a statement could be uttered by a president in 2025. Yes, slavery was bad, President Trump. It was evil and remains a stain on this country. We should never stop talking about it. Lonnie G. Bunch III is the 14th Secretary of the Smithsonian, overseeing the entire institution. Prior to that, he was the co-founder of the Smithsonian's internationally renowned National Museum of African American History and Culture. Democracy Now! Interviewed Bunch in February 2020, just before the pandemic struck. Bunch described the importance of depicting slavery.
One of the most important things for me was to talk about the slave trade. I felt that we had to find real remnants of a slave ship.
Bunch said.
We found the São José. It was a ship that left Lisbon in 1794, went all the way to Mozambique and picked up 512 people from the Makua tribe, was on its way back to the New World when it sank off the coast of Cape Town. Half of the people were lost. The other half were rescued and sold the next day.
Bunch recalled Trump's visit to the African American Museum in 2017 at the beginning of his first term as president.
The first place Donald Trump visited in an official capacity was the museum. And I think he was stunned by the stories we told. And there was so much he didn't know. What I realized is that if people who didn't know but had political influence could come through the museum, I could help them understand, hopefully, something that would change the way they did it.
Given Trump's new assault on the Smithsonian, it seems his visit to the African American Museum didn't have Lonnie Bunch's hoped-for uplifting impact. In late March of this year, Trump issued an executive order targeting the museum complex. The order alleges, quote, the Smithsonian Institution has, in recent years, come under the influence of a divisive, race-centered ideology, unquote. The order further creates a committee to review the contents of exhibits for, quote, unquote, improper ideology. Trump has set the tone, normalizing the rejection of history, of the indescribable horror of slavery in the United States. His loyalists follow suit. In 2023, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis promoted a revision to the state school curriculum to include instruction on, quote, how slaves develop skills, which in some instances could be applied for their own personal benefit, unquote. DeSantis defended the offensive guidelines, saying,
I think that they're probably going to show some of the folks that eventually parlayed, being a blacksmith into doing things later in life.
Trump's defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, recently joined a growing Christian nationalist congregation. The church's co-founder, Doug Wilson, has written that slavery, quote, produced in the South a genuine affection between the races, unquote. Hegseth has ordered that previously removed statues of Confederate officers be put back and is restoring Confederate names to military installations that had been recently removed. The National Park Service has announced the only outdoor statue in Washington, D.C., honoring a Confederate, Albert Pike, which was removed following the racial justice protests of 2020, will be restored. Pike was a Confederate general and alleged member of the Ku Klux Klan. And as Trump has successfully defunded public broadcasting, some are advocating that PBS content be replaced with material from the right-wing media company PragerU. In one clip from Prager, already being used in 10 states, an animated cartoon Christopher Columbus is shown downplaying slavery.
Being taken as a slave is better than being killed, no?
Annette Gordon-Reed, professor of history at Harvard University, president of the Organization of American Historians and Pulitzer Award-winning author, said on Democracy Now!
It's an attempt to play down or downplay what happened in the United States with slavery. This is a whitewashing of history.
With Trump's all-out assault on truth, learning, and the institutions that preserve and curate our collective history, places like the Smithsonian Institution are more important than ever.
In the era of Donald Trump,
Bunch concluded in 2020,
the museum has become a pilgrimage site, a site of resistance, a site of remembering what America could be, and a site to engage new generations to recognize they have an obligation to make a country live up to its state ideals.
I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Yeah, amazing stuff. Well, I guess the segue should be going to Sundiata Chajua's book chat, Reparations and Reparatory Justice, Past, Present, and Future. It's an anthology edited by Sundiata, Mary Frances Berry, and V.P. Franklin. It's called A General Interest Reader on the Reparations Movement. So let's reclaim some history here. I've clipped it to where he starts talking about an ex-slave who made probably the earliest suit against her owners. Okay. And some Greg Palast on election issues, but also the primary beginning of the story is about the privatization of FEMA. All right, that's the storyboard. Let's see. This segment is 19 minutes long. And don't have as much information about the next piece because I'm working on a different device. I guess I should reboot a computer or something. Not that I'm technical. Missing the late Bob Pelesny, as always. Oh, let's do some business for the station, too. Here's what's scheduled to be put on from Champaign Park District.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and the Champaign Park District. Looking for something fun to do this weekend? The Champaign Park District's Weekend Explorer email comes out every Thursday, jam-packed with ideas, events, and programs for each upcoming weekend. Information on subscribing to the Weekend Explorer can be found at champaignparks.org.
Okay, I've done some audio manipulation on this, but I think it's pretty intelligible. Sundiata at the Literary doing a book chat on the book Reparations and Reparatory Justice.
In 1783, a woman by the name of Belinda Sutton filed a suit against her former owner, Isaac Wall, who turns out to be one of the major contributors to Harvard University. And she basically argued that she had toiled all this time and that he had become rich off of part of her labor. So 1783, before the Constitution, right? And then we move on to Sojourner Truth. And we always talk about Sojourner Truth, and we talk about something that she never said, right? Ain't I a woman? She never said it. But we miss that the last years of her life was dedicated to circulating a petition and petitioning the government to set aside land in the West for African Americans as a what could become a state, an all African American state. And we move from that 19th century effort to a woman by the name of Callie House. Now, Callie House is a washerwoman, former enslaved person, and she starts a movement entitled the Ex-Slave Mutual Bounty and Relief Association. They have, according to the U.S. government, in 1915, they have 300,000 members. Their record suggests that they had 600,000 people who paid a nickel a month to be part of this. And what we now know is that the Garvey movement that we always talk about as the largest black movement, it is the largest black movement if you speak in terms of worldwide. But if you speak in terms of the US, it's far behind the National African American Farmers Association and just a little bit above Callie House's organization. So Callie House in 1916 sued the US government. And what she wanted was $68 million that the North collected from the sale of cotton taxes from the Confederacy. And she felt that that money should go to African Americans, right? They lost the suit, and she was charged with using the mails to defraud and incarcerate it. Same charge that Garvey would be charged with and incarcerated about 5-6 years later. And so we move from that to a woman by the name of Queen Mother Moore. Now, Queen Mother Moore had been a Garveyite, had been a member of the Communist Party USA. And I knew her as, I guess I was probably in my 30s, and I'd go to the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, and she would be there with a big sign, Reparations Now. And at that time, she had to be in her 70s, right? But she formed in 1962 an organization of the descendants of slavery for reparations. And that gets followed with probably the major event in at least my lifetime would be James Forman. James Forman, operating through the League of Revolutionary Black Workers and their national coalition, right, of black workers, put forward the Black Manifesto. It went before, I guess it was the Rockefeller's Church, Riverside, in New York, and issued a demand for $40 million from churches to go to African Americans. And I can say that the $40 million didn't materialize, but my first job as a 16-year-old was to work as a community organizer for the Black Central Coordinating Committee in Decatur, Illinois. With part of the money that came from white churches because of the Black Manifesto. And so we go through that and we come down to the formation of NCOBRA, which was a coalition. And it's very important here to point out that it's the elements of the black community, the radical sector of the movement, that has always pushed reparations. So we're talking about Malcolm X grassroots movement. We're talking about Black Alliance for Peace. We're talking about those radical organizations. But by the time we get to 2000, the mainstream black organizations, including every major sorority and fraternity, has taken up reparations. So by the time we're in the mid-2000s, reparations is the single issue in which the largest number and percentage of African Americans agree on. Right? Single largest issue by far.
When I was young, we used to say, "Now, what is that and how can I get me some?" So what is this reparations and this justice thing about, and how can us give us some?
That's a deep, you know, it seems like a simple question. So essentially, and one of the things we do is that in the first article in the book is a timeline of the reparation movement in the United States, but it does include a few international cases. So that we want to make clear that this is a long movement. Now, we think of reparations as compensation, repair, and restitution. So we're talking about compensation for enslavement, the slave trade, and let me just throw something out that people rarely engage. But when we talk about the slave trade, the European slave trade, we're talking about something that began in 1441 and continued until the 1860s. In fact, it's 1860 that the last ship bringing captive Africans to the U.S. arrives in the U.S., 1860. Now, if we go back and we look at the numbers, a lot of people want to focus on how many people were transplanted from Africa to the Americas and to Europe. That's the wrong way to look at this. The way to look at it is, what was the overall impact on the African continent? And when we do that, we take the world's best demographers, and they've charted out the population of the continents from 1450 to 1900. And if you look from 1750 to 1900, what we find is that the African population only increased by 33 million. Everywhere else, like Asia, it went from 200 something million to over 400 million. Europe went from 100 million to maybe 300 million, on and on and on. So what we do then is we start looking at the fact that 64% of the people captured were captured through a violent process. It's a raid on a village. It's a kidnapping. Then they got to be forcibly walked maybe as far as a couple hundred miles to the shore. Then they wait in these barracoons for 3 to 4 months. Then the Middle Passage, which we all know is horrendous, right? Then they arrive where in their destiny. And so what we end up with is something like 106 million Africans died as a consequence of the slave trade. 106 million, okay? In Haiti, once a person was brought in, their life expectancy was 7 years. They literally worked them to death. The U.S. came close. Right, about 8 or 9 years in the early days, they just worked people to death and they'd return to the continent and get folk. So we have to think about it in those terms. So when we talk about compensation, we're talking not just payment for what was produced. And we have to understand something, right? As late as 1860, 75% of all U.S. exports were products that were produced by enslaved Africans. Coffee, tobacco, cotton, of course, cotton, right? Cotton was king, sugar was queen. right? That made the international world. That is, in fact, the origin of capitalism, if you read Karl Marx, is in the slave trade, right? Racial capitalism. I told you I'd get it in for you. So we're talking about compensation for those who died. We're talking about the trauma, right? People had their children, their loved ones snatched and stole and sold, right? We're talking about dismemberment as a form of punishment. We're talking about the ways in which people were, every mechanism was used to keep people in ignorance, right? So we're talking about compensation. We're talking about 100 years after freedom, before you begin to say, this is interesting, T. Thomas Fortune, the most famous black journalist of the 19th century, he said in 1884 that it would take 100 years before the Reconstruction Amendments, meaning the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, would be realized. And if we just look at it, what we call the Second Reconstruction, the Civil Rights Movement, isn't it the 1960s? 100 years before you get the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65, the Fair Housing Act of 1968, Loving v. Virginia, 67. So Fortune was right. It took 100 years to get those things enacted. So we're talking about compensation for that 100 years. And if someone were to say to you today that black people do not still suffer forms of discrimination, out and out police murder, right? Exploitation, being confined to subproletarian jobs, meaning part-time, temporary, low-paying, ununionized, benefitless jobs have become the dominant category of African-American labor, right? So we're talking that this is the whole experience that we need to be compensated for. Repair means to fix. Fix the damage, right? And say you're never gonna do it again, right? Fix the damage, say you're never gonna do it again. And here comes the hard one for folk. Restitution means to return you to the status that you previously had. Now, there's a lot of views in the reparations movement. I represent one view. I represent the view of the Revolutionary Nationalist Forces. And our view is that the most important thing that was taken was sovereignty, the right to self-determination. And so when we talk about restitution, we mean return sovereignty, our right to determine our destiny. That can take many forms. One form, we want 5 Deep South states, period. Right? Another form, we want an autonomous zones throughout the U.S. Could be a consociational state in which representation is not based on the silly premise of an individual, but on the premise of a group. Right? And it could be finance our return to the motherland. But those are options that we should have had, because in 1865, slavery was abolished. We did not become citizens until 1868, 3 years. What's our status? We're free, but we're unable to make the most critical decisions about our destiny. Our argument is that in those 3 years, the U.S. should have done a plebiscite and asked our people, where do you want to go? What do you want? And if we follow the logic of the government, the radical Republicans, what did they do during the war? They said all the land from Charleston, South Carolina to St. Augustine, Florida, 50 miles inland, and the islands of the sea are given to the Negroes in perpetuity. And then they murdered, assassinated Abraham Lincoln. And Andrew Johnson sent in the Union troops to take the land back. What did the radical Republicans do? Because we were locked out of the first Homestead Act, they issued a second Homestead Act and said only people of African descent. for the first 6 months can buy land. And when they passed the 1870 Naturalization Act, they said only Europeans and Africans and people of African descent can come to the United States and become a naturalized citizen. So the Radical Republicans was on point in terms of trying to deal reparations, and it gets undercut. So when we talk about compensation, repair, and restitution, that's what we mean by reparations. How do we get it? That's what we're trying to figure out.
That's what we're trying to figure out. How do we get us you wanted to make sure we talked about this idea of cultural appropriation as it refers to reparations. Can you say something about that?
You know, Sinners, and I'm sure most people who saw the film Sinners, right? It really does put cultural appropriation on the table again. But we need to do it in this type of framework, right? First, we have to talk about culture as an industry.
Yes.
It's a capitalist industry. So when we talk about those folk, anybody here familiar with the term cover? When we talk about music, you know what a cover is?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, black artists produce something, write a song, produce it, then a white artist comes, take all the seasoning out, right, the flavor, and sells it to a white artist, and it sells millions. Black artists never got those royalties. Who's my man? Wabba Baba Bing. Little Richard has spoken eloquently about what was taken from him in that regard. So when we talk about cultural programming, the first thing we have to do is talk about it as an industry, and that means that the compensation must come in monetary terms, right? Give people the rights. Secondly, we're talking about the ways in which African-American culture has enriched the United States. And I would say that if we're honest, right, if we're honest with the spirituals, jazz, gospel, R&B did for the U.S. is humanize. Right? Humanization is what they brought. And so all of those things that we contributed to this culture that we've not gotten any credit for, like odd things that people wouldn't think about. When you think about country music, and I'm not talking about this mess now that's not really country, it's just that they have a certain attitude, but it's not what we think of as country music, right? Country music used to be defined by the yodel. Well, the yodel is a West African form of singing. And it just so happened that the people who would go on to produce country music, right, lived in the mountains and in the hills. They were poor slave owners or poor whites. But because of their isolation, they preserved what they had taken from Africans in terms of the yodel, even after African Americans ceased to perform that musical aspect and came to see it as something done by quote-unquote white folk. So the things that have been contributed are vast. And so the first thing we need is an acknowledgement that culturally this country has leaned more toward the African side than ever admitted to. And those things that have been African have been humanizing.
Okay, I could have done some ambient sound filtering there, I guess. That was Sundiata Chajwa at the book chat for the book published by U of I Press that I had in front of me, Reparations and Reparatory Justice, Past, Present, and Future. It's an anthology edited by Sundiata Chajwa, Mary Frances Berry, and V.P. Franklin, a general interest reader on reparations. Good follow on to the essay Breaking the Sound Barrier with Amy Goodman about the attack on the Smithsonian and honest history. About a little more than halfway through, and I've got about a half hour of Greg Palast with Dennis Bernstein, ending with discussion of voting and the voter suppression that's mounting already. So not only gerrymandering, but voter suppressing. So the margins are going to be less in the Redon district, so you have to do more to disqualify voters to make sure that something untoward doesn't happen to their devious plan. Speaking of devious plan, David Daley, author of Rat Blanked, but now has the book out, Anti-Democratic. He was on Democracy Now! Talking about voter issues, subtitled Inside the Far Right's 50-Year Plot to Control Elections. And yeah, just wanted to mention that before I play Palace. There are a lot of people doing good work. He's with Daley's with the group Fair Vote. So that link can be found at Democracy Now! Consequently, all right, I will be excerpting this. This is from the 19th of August, a few days ago, on Flashpoints for the rest of it.
Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We are happy to welcome back Mr. Greg Palast, investigative reporter, with some powerful new material. His material has everything to do with what will happen without FEMA. He's got a new piece that's extremely troubling. His arm slid off like a chicken wing. Greg Palast, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Glad to be with you, Dennis.
It's good to have you with us. It is not good to understand what's going to happen if FEMA disappears. Well, why don't you maybe start this way? What's the difference between these six letters? On the one hand, these three, LSU, and on the other hand, IEM. Can you define the letters and what they mean?
Yes. So we're heading into the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, which, by the way, never hit New Orleans. There was a storm surge which destroyed the city. And FEMA and IEM. So right now, by the way, we've picked up 139 bodies from the rivers in Texas. We expect 100 more. And we're about to have a hurricane coming into Hatteras in the Carolinas. So, but 20 years ago, we had Katrina hit. And right now, Donald Trump wants to eliminate FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, by December. And he's already done a good job of taking it apart. One third of the Emergency Management Agency, which are our lifeguards in the case of a flood, have been fired. And in Texas, the reason why those kids drowned is that DOGE, under Elon Musk and now under this guy, Vought, Elon Musk eliminated a third of the positions in FEMA on the way to eliminating the entire agency. But that included the National Weather Service FEMA coordinator to warn local towns about dangers coming in evacuation. So when Kerr County and Kerrville was facing a massive flash flood, there was no FEMA coordinator because they'd been that position been eliminated by DOGE. So if we eliminated FEMA, I hope you learn how to swim and keep a raft near your house. And that goes for fires, toxic spills, hurricanes, any disaster. FEMA is there, supposed to be the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And you know, I'm going to tell you, Dennis, every time something goes wrong, everyone says the same thing. Where was the government? Well, you voted to end the government, pinheads. And in Texas, they voted for Donald Trump. They voted to eliminate FEMA, and their kids drowned. So if you want to donate your kids to the MAGA campaign, go right ahead. I'm sorry I'm being harsh about it, but there's no other way to put it. These parents donated their kids to MAGA. They got what they voted for. And, you know, if that sounds cruel, I'm sorry. That's what happened. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because there's other towns that are in danger. And the group IEM, they were – okay, just so you understand, if you watch my film All Washed Away, which I originally did for Democracy Now!, now it's expanded for an hour, which you can get on YouTube, All Washed Away. That film explains how before New Orleans was drowned, Louisiana State University had come up with an elaborate plan to evacuate New Orleans in case of a flood. And the head of the Hurricane Center, by the way, got on British TV on my program a month before the flood in New Orleans and said, this town could be underwater in a month. And he nailed it exactly. It was. They turned down the LSU evacuation plan because George W. Bush decided he was going to privatize evacuation planning, which is exactly what Trump wants to do for all of FEMA. And so they canned the LSU elaborate plan for evacuating the city safely, instead hired this private firm, which had virtually no evacuation plan. And the plan that they had when I finally got my hands on it didn't include 127,000 residents of the New Orleans area who had no automobile to escape. Their whole plan was get in your car and go. Well, a lot of people couldn't get in their car and go. And you'll see in my film, All Washed Away, that, for example, a guy, African-American, Stephen Smith, and it's not accidental that he's African-American. He had no car. He didn't know how to swim. He floated on a mattress and saved several people off of rooftops, took them to a bridge above the water. Helicopters, including George Bush's PR helicopter, flew over them. They couldn't get their attention. And the grandfather on the bridge died because he gave his last bottle of water to his grandchildren. And Stephen Smith had to close his eyes on this dead man. That's what happens when you privatize emergency evacuation planning. That's what Trump wants to do for the entire United States of America.
Absolutely. Greg, tell us about, and this is, one of the things about your journalism is it is straight up and it is not make-believe. Sometimes it sounds fantastic, but it's unbelievable. So tell us about Village Board President Kevin Patrick and okay. Villa Park, Illinois, and, quote, his arm slid off like a chicken wing.
Okay, this is very important to understand. The way that Trump plays it is that when he takes away all these programs like FEMA, it's all about, you know, getting rid of the welfare for those dark people and the, you know, urban centers, which is, you know, the code, you know, dog whistle for black people. It's not just black people who drown. Yes, in New Orleans, it was mostly black people who drown. But guess what? You eliminate FEMA. Kevin Patrick is the supervisor, kind of the mayor of the town of Villa Park, Illinois, which is west of Chicago, a little town, 22,000. And he's a career Coast Guard officer. And he was the first responder when Katrina hit. His Coast Guard crew was the first into Gulfport, Mississippi. And he talked about pulling dead pregnant women out of the water. And he talked about, he grabbed one corpse and the arm slid off like a chicken wing, he said. And that these nightmares still haunt him. And what he's concerned about when he saw all that devastation. And go to gregpalace.com. You can read with Kevin or see the film All Washed Away. It's on YouTube free. And he said, what happens if there's a train wreck in my town? They have a couple of rail lines. Remember, East Palestine had a toxic rail spill in Pennsylvania and or Ohio. And he said, what happens if that happens in my town? Who am I going to call? His only place to call was FEMA. He saw what happens when FEMA fails and evacuation is privatized. He pulled the dead bodies out of the water. He said, I don't want that to ever happen in my town. I don't want to see people in my town floating face down on Main Street. And so if you go and see the film, All Washed Away, you'll see Kevin Patrick and pictures from his time at Katrina. But you have to understand, I did I actually worked on an evacuation plan for Long Island, New York. It's the richest area in America, the Hamptons. We spent $20 million on an evacuation plan. How does a town of 22,000 people, how does small town America, which supposedly Donald Trump loves, how do they plan for a disaster? What the heck do they do if they can't call FEMA, if they can't get evacuation plans, if they can't get help? He's scared because he saw what happened. And it gives him nightmares. And he says, that's going to happen to me unless we stop Trump's privatization of FEMA and the elimination of Federal Emergency Management Agency. No, if you have a flood or if you have a toxic spill and people are dying, you're supposed to call Walmart? We appreciate your call. Hold on. No. Understand that there are consequences, as he said, If FEMA dies, a lot of Americans are going to die.
We're talking to Greg Palast. We're talking about, really, plans by Donald Trump. And believe me, these are on the front burner. He wants to cancel, essentially, FEMA, privatize FEMA. And what happens, and it's already begun, Greg. I mean, they're already experiencing the suffering. The towns are being hit. The storms are stirring up. And people are facing the reality that there is no help. There is going to be no help. Some people are panicking. Other people don't really realize what's about to happen. I mean, we have a bad season of storms, and we're gonna see a lot of Katrina revised.
Yeah. You know, first of all, and then plus the viciousness of it. In California here, I'm calling from L.A., was on fire. Trump has refused any help for Maryland, a state with a Democratic government. They refused the what's automatically given is emergency help. Really? You're whether you're in a red state or blue state is whether you live or die? Well, the problem is whether you're in a red state or blue state, let me tell you, if they get rid of FEMA, you're all going to die. And I'm sorry to put it in stark terms, but that's literally what we're looking at.
We're looking down the barrel of this gun of the next storm, that's for sure. Greg, what do you suppose people can do? I mean, they can learn a lot. They can learn a lot from your work. Are there organizations at the grassroots level? We know that we remember interviewing Raheem some time ago. He's in the first version of your film. But how are people preparing, and what are they doing? What kind of resistance is there at this point?
Here's the problem. I mean, if you watch my film All Washed Away, when I originally did it for you and Amy Goodman, it after Katrina 20 years ago, now it's been updated, and here's the problem. Raheem Malik, he rebuilt housing for the people whose houses were washed away in New Orleans. What we didn't know when, after the film, that first version of the film, now you'll find in the second, is that the landlords of that building, after this community group put in thousands of hours of sweat equity and literally put in a couple million dollars of their own money, the landlord just took the property back. And that's what happens. New Orleans become a real estate hotspot. The black people in Ninth Ward have not come back. Instead, it's become Yuppieville. They tore down, as you'll see in my film, they tore down the public housing at Lafitte Housing, which, by the way, was not one of the only pieces of housing not affected by Katrina because it was up on high ground. But they tore it down anyway because it was in between the downtown and the French Quarter. And so this was going to be – so they turned it – they tore down all these this wonderful public housing. It was wonderful. There's one of the rare public housing things was little townhouses and stuff, beautiful. They tore it all down so they can make yuppie housing and eliminate – black folk. But you ask what can be done, and it segues into the other work I do on voting. Listen, when Katrina hit, before Katrina hit, Louisiana was a blue state. It was a majority, it was a Democratic state with a Democratic governor, Democratic senators. When the hurricane hit, it wiped out all them black people. And suddenly, the voter list turned. It was washed lily white. And so Louisiana turned Republican. And I'm not being partisan about it. That's just the damn effect of what happens. Listen, the Republican Party was not unhappy about a flood that wipes people out. You talk about Hatteras and some of these small black beach communities that are, as we speak, are being faced with hurricane wipeout. You know what? The GOP is going to be happy with that because they don't want these people, folks, to vote. And that's the other part of this. You can never dissociate these actions from the effect on voting and who controls our democracy.
Talk about the group called Innovative Energy Management, because they're the ones
Innovative
that,
Emergency, yeah.
Go on, please.
Well, Innovative Emergency Management, IEM, while LSU had given the federal government, given the state government, given New Orleans, a whole plan to safely evacuate the city of New Orleans in case of a storm surge or hurricane, which is what happened. You'll see it in the film All Washed Away. You know, go to GregPalast.com. It's free. Innovative Emergency Management took away the contract using their connections to George W. Bush at the time in 2005. I took away the contract from LSU, which, by the way, offered their program for free. But IEM was getting a big fee from the Bush guys to come up with an evacuation plan for New Orleans, even though they had a good one. And why were they picked? Number one, they were giving tons of money to the Republican Party. They had zero experience in emergency evacuation. The second thing is that they claimed that they had Bill Clinton's FEMA director, James Lee Witt, who was legendary for his competence in evacuation. They said he was on their team. That's how they got the contract from the Bush guys. But he told me he had nothing to do with these people. He didn't know who the hell they were. So they used flimflam to get this privatized contract, which didn't include any plan for people without cars. Well, who are they? Poor people, right? It's not like rich people don't have cars. And so we know what color those people were. And they were the ones who went floating face down, 1,500 people in Louisiana. And IEM, when I went to their offices to ask them, where is this emergency evacuation plan? Because I called Bush's Homeland Security, where FEMA is under Homeland Security, Kristi Noem right now. And I said, where's the evacuation plan? They said, it's a national security secret. I said, wait a minute. How do you have an evacuation plan that's a secret? How do people evacuate? How does anyone know where to evacuate? Well, you know, it's like, this is the crazy stuff. It was all flimflam to cover over the fact that they really had no plan. And I went to IEM's office in Baton Rouge, and they were the executives of the company. When I walked into their office with the camera, they literally physically hid from me. And then I had to call them and speak to them. I said, you know, you're like 12 feet from me. Finally, some spokesman came out. And I said, where's your plan for evacuating New Orleans? And their response was to call the police on me and have me thrown out. Now, here's the kicker. Innovative Emergency Management, these guys who basically had a plan which ended up with 1,500 people dead in New Orleans, who lied about James Lee Witt, this same company has a contract with DOGE right now on emergency evacuation plan. So if we get rid of FEMA, that's who you get. These scoundrels, and I don't use the word scoundrels easily. I'm now a columnist for Raw Story. I don't think the lawyers will let me say that. It's like, this is what you're going to get when they privatize FEMA. You're going to get people who have no idea how to plan an emergency evacuation. You're on your own. And that's what scares the hell out of Kevin Patrick, this supervisor for this little town. He says, we understand what happens when you're all alone and you have a toxic spill, a flood, a fire, tornadoes hit. You're supposed to be able to call FEMA. He says, what happens when we can't? It's bad enough. There's no one to call. We're on our own. People will die. That's just that simple.
It's amazing. Listen, Greg, that's extraordinary information. We are speaking with Greg Palast, gregpalast.com. We're talking about the end, what will happen if FEMA is totally privatized and there is no ability to respond to some of the more difficult storms that people are facing now as global warming kicks in. The other side, if they don't kill all the brown and black people in storms without protection, they're certainly going to make sure that they can vote and speak out about it. And the other thing that you've really devoted a great deal of your time to, Greg, very effectively, is working to defend people's right to vote. And we're hearing a lot about, I thought of you, and we're hearing a lot about the inability to vote by mail, to have mail-in ballots. Could you talk a little bit about the implications around that? Because nobody knows more about this than you.
The implications are two words, Jim Crow. Let me tell you something, Dennis. In most states, African Americans vote 70% in advance, either by mail or by early voting. And this is a whole program to shut down early voting and vote by mail. And let me give you some numbers that should just make you feel sick, I hope, which is Georgia, where I concentrate on. In 2020, Joe Biden won by 12,000 votes in Georgia for one reason, is that Georgia mailed out ballots to every voter in the state because of COVID. But then what happened is that 1.1 million people used those mail-in ballots and put them in drop boxes. So they passed a law, SB 202, which eliminated drop boxes, cut early voting from 60 days to 9 days. And the result was predictable, going from 1.1 million mail-in ballots put in drop boxes to 100,000. That is a 90% reduction in the number of mail-in ballots put in drop boxes. 90% reduction. And guess what? African Americans vote 70% early or by mail. They knew exactly whose votes they were blocking. It was almost entirely in Atlanta. And that's how Donald Trump flipped the state from blue to red in 2024. You know, forget all the BS about, you know, the manosphere and all that. It's because they knocked out early voting, and they knocked out drop box voting, and they knocked out mail-in voting. That's what happened. You have, in most states, you have a majority of African Americans, again, voting by mail and voting early. The reason is, for example, if you go to gregpowles.com, you'll see me walking along a line in Atlanta for people voting. It was a two-hour line to get in to vote. I go to the white suburbs. There's not only no line, there's like a line of voting workers waiting for people to vote. Zero wait. 2 hours if you're in the black community, zero wait if you're in the white community. And therefore, black people learn, let's mail in our vote. But then that's under attack too. But if you get rid of, I'm stunned that the Democratic Party has not looked at this issue of mail-in voting. I've been screaming about, if they take away mail-in voting, there'll never be another Democrat elected in any swing area in America. And it's not that I'm for or against. I don't care. You vote Democratic, you vote for Republican. That's up to you. But we shouldn't have rules which make it impossible or difficult for you to vote. And people in black community don't want to wait. I mean, I was in Ohio. People were waiting 7 hours to vote in Cleveland.
And they constructed laws, right, Greg? They constructed laws. When the people are waiting 2 and 3 and 4 hours, it became a crime to bring water to them, to help them refresh themselves. So people are sort of fainting on the line.
You have elderly people. You have old people waiting. And you have to understand the Georgia heat. So in the Georgia heat, you're waiting 3 hours in line to vote. Again, this is only in black communities, only in black communities. And in those black communities, you're waiting 3-4 hours in line in the Georgia sun. And if you give someone a bottle of water, you've committed a felony crime. If you give someone a slice of pizza because they're waiting and they're hungry, you're committing a felony crime. I mean, it's all, you know, it's about, if you want to vote, it's going to be cruel. It's going to be difficult. You're going to wait. You're going to fry. You know, this is the games that they play. I mean, I just saw horrible stuff when the cops stopped. There was a 2-hour line. People showed up at like 30 seconds before closing time. And the cops said, no, you can't vote. This is America. You know, we play all these games with voting. And then on top of it, they, you know, so one thing that Trump is saying is that, oh, we have to get rid of mail-in balloting because it's easy to commit fraud. Well, I got to tell you, the Republican Party went through those mail-in ballots, like in some cases, 5 times, Dennis, 5 times. They didn't find not one single illegal ballot. You can't, if you look at your ballot in California, most of your listeners in California, if you look at your ballot, a mail-in ballot.
Well, we're not in California. That's Greg Palast starting out talking about the privatization of FEMA and then getting back to his usual beat, which is election suppression and fixing the vote. As I mentioned, Dave Daly was on Democracy Now! Yesterday with another analysis about that. Not different, but another dimension of that. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. I think it's time for another small business underwriting announcement, and then we're going to kick it with Funkadelics for Radio Free Labor. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting community media now more than ever. Very necessary.
Support for WEFT programming is made possible in part by Bash Pepper Roofing. Large or small, they cover them all, commercial or residential. Bash Pepper Roofing offers roofing and re-roofing, gutters, siding, and door needs. For more information, 217-352-2200 or online at bashpepper.com.